So we finished up last class talking about waist to hip ratios. So moving on here, talk a little bit about symmetry. We are a bilaterally symmetric species. If you if we took and held a really big axe or sword right over your head and let it drop straight down through you, you'd be dead. But we'd also have two symmetric halves of you. So that's what we mean by bilateral symmetry. Something like a starfish has got what we call a radial symmetry. Now, you're all bilaterally symmetric, but you're not all perfectly bilaterally symmetric. If you do something like, you know, just put your hands together and line up the little creases in your fingers and look at this, you'll probably find that not all of the joints of your finger... No, okay, a few people are doing this. I put your hands together, brothers and sisters, and don't pray, just look at the little creases in your fingers. Okay, right. They're probably not all exactly the same length. I mean, these fingers here, this joint is longer on my right hand than on the left hand. Oh my gosh, that's called fluctuating asymmetries. Everybody's got a little bit of fluctuating asymmetry, up to maybe a lot of fluctuating asymmetry. Fluctuating asymmetries are just small, random differences in the overall symmetry of an organism's body. And they're due to your genotype interacting with the environment. So we're getting back to a phenotypic indicator of fitness here. The better your genotype is at dealing with environmental stressors, the more symmetric you'll be, the less fluctuating asymmetry you will have. So this gets back, as so many things do, to the immune system. Okay, the better your immune system is at dealing with stressors, the more symmetric you're likely to be. Gets back to your sex hormones. As I think we mentioned earlier, I almost mentioned in that little video clip, testosterone in males, estrogen to a lesser degree in females, but still does this, both have an impact on the immune system. They both negatively impact the immune system. So if you've got these various characteristics that are produced by your secondary sex hormones, and they're still symmetric, okay, that's indicating that you've got a good underlying immune system. So we get back to these honest signals. This is not just something unique to humans. There's a grad student here in entomology years ago that did this with house flies. He took and would find house flies that female flies, male flies that female flies would want to mate with, and then he'd, you know, so he'd take the sexy male fly, and then he'd flip off part of one of their wings, one of the male's wings. Suddenly he was no longer sexy. Glue a little bit back on, make them more symmetric again. Oh, very attractive. Okay. So we have similar things in humans as well. This is not unique to humans. All right. Age. Age is another issue here that comes into mate choice. Going back to Buss's giant cross-cultural survey, 37 cultures, over 10,000 participants from 89, found that on average, given the choice, given the preference, men would prefer to marry a woman about, roughly 2.5 years younger. And women would prefer, again, given the choice, to marry a man about 3.5 years older. Now, we've talked about issues of interbirth interval. 2.5 years is almost another child, if you look at it this way, for a woman. So, if the male is able to find a mate that's 2.5 odd years younger than he is, if he stays with her, that's practically one more child that they can produce together over the woman's reproductive lifespan. What about from women preferring slightly older males? Well, we've discussed that women may be looking strongly for issues like resource or potential for resource. So you've got your 18-year-old guy who's graduated from a high school, and his prospects are, we don't know. His resources are, what kind of job is your average 18-year-old going to get straight out of high school? It probably involves asking about fried potato products. maybe something a little bit better. But compare that to somebody who's 3.5, a male 3.5 years older, almost finishing up their university degree. Now, I know, it may not seem like there's great jobs out there, but survey says getting a university degree will lead to, on average, at least a 20% increase in your lifetime earnings over not having a university degree. So, probably be able to get a better job. Better job, more resources. More resources, well, it's attractive to the ladies. Apparently, the other thing that's attractive to the ladies, the Canadian Research Report just came out with, and I've known this actually for a while, the press has picked up on it, like it's this amazingly surprising thing. We've known this for about the last 20 years, but never mind. Canadian study just came out showing that men, in terms of short-term relationships, become highly attractive to, if women are smiling, that's very attractive. Guys, for just for first impressions, smiling doesn't work so well with the ladies. Looking somewhat brooding, maybe a little bit pouty, a little bit guilty as if you know you've done something wrong. Apparently that is very, very hot. Yeah. James Dean, Edward the Vampire, you know. Think like that. So. But don't smile right away, apparently. Now, this is only apparently for short-term, first impressions. Right? So, yeah. And apparently be a little bit older. So. Okay. So, a couple of terms here I should just introduce. Fertility and reproductive value. Fertility refers to your current probability of successful reproduction. Are you fertile now or not? Can you produce offspring or not? How likely are you to be able to produce offspring right now or not? Second term here, reproductive value, sometimes gets tossed about. Reproductive value actually was derived, it's a term derived from demographic data, so demographers who look at large numbers, so population size numbers over time. Reproductive value refers to the age-specific future likelihood of offspring production. Well, basically what it's saying here is at birth, so you are born, what is your potential future reproductive, you know, likelihood of future reproduction? The scale of reproductive value goes from 0 to 1. Right at birth, almost anything is possible. So, 1. But then it kind of drops down because of possibility of death during early childhood. Then it starts going up, okay, back up again. And for women, it peaks somewhere in the early 20s and then starts declining gradually. You hit the 40s, mid-40s or so, menopause is coming, starts dropping down quickly. Males, the reproductive value stays up a bit higher for a bit longer. Doesn't do really a sudden drop-off there until you maybe get into the 60s or so. So it's really the future expected reproductive success. Now, again, it's not, this came out of demographic data, so you don't really talk about reproductive value with respect to individuals per se. When demographers deal with this, they tend to work in like 5-year cohorts. So the reproductive value for 20 to 25 year olds, kind of these sorts of things there. So we can use this to say, okay, so we've got someone who is in the 35 to 40 year old range. What is their future reproductive value? What do we expect they might still be able to accomplish here? And we could also look at what their overall average lifetime reproductive value could be. So you may encounter these terms depending on what you're doing for your papers. Okay. I just wanted to talk about that briefly. Okay, a few other terms here. Now, there's unfortunately not a huge amount of consistency in how terms dealing with mating styles work, especially when you get into humans. If you're working with non-humans, this is actually much easier. So, monogamy, for example. Well, monogamy is the long-term pair bonding with one mate. Seems pretty straightforward, right? How long-term? If you get divorced and then remarry, are you really being monogamous? What about serial monogamy? So you're not cheating on your partner when you're with your partner, But as soon as you break up, you move on to another partner. Is that monogamous or not? Now, for most of the non-humans, we don't really get into things like this. In the case of even, say, people talk about robins. Robins will mate for life. The male will get back first and wait for his mate to reappear and show up and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, you know, they'll both cheat with other robins if they can get away with it. Turtle doves cheat. Sparrows cheat. Songbirds cheat. Finches cheat. They all cheat. Dirty birds. Give them the chance. And why not? If you can get away with it and get access to better genes, go for it. So, in some cases, you know, what often looks like monogamy in the non-human species is really just some form of arrangement with the possibility of extra pair copulations. But in humans, we tend to put sort of a significant value on this. We ascribe morals and ethics and cultural values to these sorts of things. We don't really have to worry about that, right? Is the sparrow going to hell for cheating on its mate? What is sparrow hell? Like, you just can't get to the bird feeder? I don't know. We don't have to worry about that. Is the sparrow going to be ostracized by other sparrows for cheating on its mate? No, not really. There is no moral or sort of ethical values within the non-humans. But in humans, we definitely stick this in there. So we say, oh, yeah, we are a monogamous culture. Well, are we really? So, monogamy. Long-term pair bond with one mate. Whatever that means. Okay. Let's just say longish-term pair bond with one mate. With possibly, you know, some sort of extra pair copulations tossed in there every now and then. Then we get into polygamy. Polygamy just means one mate with multiple others at the same time. Now, very traditionally, when this was looked at, it was seen as a male with multiple females, a harem. More specifically, we need to break polygamy down into polygyny, which is a male with multiple female mates at the same time, and polyandry, female with multiple male mates. You might say, wait, isn't this just promiscuity? If you've got, say, a male with multiple female mates at the same time. See, this is where this gets tricky with humans. If you look at something like elk, or deer, or oxen, or something, right? You've got the dominant male, mates with lots of females, all during the mating season, all at about the same time. Once the mating season is over, it's not really mating with anybody. Females aren't mating with anybody else, the males are not mating with anybody else, it's all done. So, these sorts of ideas about, well, is it just promiscuity, one male trying to mate with lots of females, doesn't really apply for many of the non-human mammals. In fact, most of the non-human mammals do follow a polygyny sort of process where a dominant male, will secure mating access to most of the females in the local group, or a large number of females at the same, or roughly the same time. Polyandry is unusual in mammals. Yeah. Depending how you look at it. I mean, if you look at something like cats, so female cats in heat may mate with up to 10 males. And because of the interesting little nature of cats, that is, they have, they release multiple eggs at once, you may end up with the sperm from different daddies fertilizing the different eggs, so you get a completely mixed up litter. You get a whole bunch of step-sibling kittens, I guess you'd have to say. Should we call this polyandry? Or is it just sort of promiscuous? The sort of traditional usage of these terms was to suggest that polygamy, with the subsets of polygyny and polygamy, involves some sort of longish-term relationship. The concept of not exactly exclusivity, but that there was a longish term kind of connection, or at least recognized bondings within the mating season. So cats probably would just fall into the promiscuous descriptor here. I can't really think of any mammals that, besides humans, in one culture that do polyandry. Only culture of humans that, at least in recorded times, has practiced polyandry on a sort of cultural level is Tibet. Basically, the agricultural potential for Tibet completely sucks. I mean, it's crap. One man cannot successfully grow enough food to sustain, at least not usually, cannot usually get a chunk of land that can sustain enough food by being worked by himself to support a wife and children. So what commonly, traditionally would happen in Tibet is that brothers would collectively marry one woman, and they would work the farm together, usually the eldest brother would be the one that was producing the children. Occasionally younger brothers would too. It gets back to, I think we talked about turkey brotherhoods. It's not dissimilar to the turkey brotherhoods. All the brothers work together, but the eldest or most dominant is the one that tends to actually reproduce. So inclusive fitness issues there. It's quite rare. There are some birds that do polyandry, but it's a fairly unusual setup. Polygyny, though, is much more common. Now, again, you know, once we get into humans, this gets a little bit difficult to nail down. And part of the problem with using these terms in evolutionary psychology is that evolutionary psychologists, the people that call themselves evolutionary psychologists, tend to come out of different backgrounds. So if you're somebody coming into evolutionary psychology from, say, an anthropological background, you might view polygyny and polyandry as being recognized as marriage practices within a culture. So you could have, for example, then, if you have a culture that accepts a male having multiple wives, you could say you have a polygynous system that would not be recognized, would not be promiscuous. I mean, wait a minute, the male's having sex with lots of women here. It's like, ah, yes. These women are all his wives. As long as he's only having sex with his wives, he's not being promiscuous, nor is he cheating on them, because within the culture, that's now, if he goes off and is having an affair with somebody that he's not married to, yeah, that's promiscuity. So from a cultural anthropology perspective, that makes perfect sense. For somebody coming at this out of a biological perspective, coming out of biology, here's like, that's kind of weird. What does the culture have to do with it? We should be just looking at the biological processes and say, well, does the male actually control access to all these females? Yeah. Okay. So we get into these ambiguities, which is a little bit unfortunate there. The way I tend to use these here is that the monogamy and polygamy, again, are going to be sort of, if we're dealing with humans, and we're talking about non-humans, this gets a little bit different, but if we're dealing with humans, let's look at sort of what are the culturally accepted relationship practices. Whether or not you want to call it marriage or not, I mean, you can be in a long-term relationship, never actually technically, legally get married, but if you're not cheating on anyone else in that, okay, fine, call it a monogamous relationship. Promiscuity is what we can probably describe as males and females just having multiple short-term partners, possibly overlapping time periods, sorts of things. Chimpanzees are promiscuous, okay? Gorillas are not. So even when we look in the primates, we get a range of things. Usually the eldest, most dominant male gorilla mates with the fertile females. He gets too old, he gets displaced, the next one comes in. Chimpanzees, both bonobos and the common chimps, are just promiscuous. Dominant males may try to control access to females, but it usually doesn't work. at least not in the wild. It can work in, say, enclosed areas like zoos or game parks or things like that, preserves, but in the wild, really, males can't. Even a dominant male can't really keep access to the females all to himself. Let's take a look at a few different primates here and how they do it. Savannah baboons. In savannah baboons, males will leave their birth troop and they will join up with another troop nearby. This cuts down on inbreeding. Okay? So by leaving, this spreads the genes around. Males are about twice the size of females. So in the savannah baboons, we get a massive sexual size dimorphism. Okay? And of the males, the biggest, strongest, meanest male typically is the dominant male. That's the one that's going to have access to the other, access to the females in the troop. Because the males typically are not, within a troop, are not related, you don't tend to get any form of kin selection that cuts down on intrasexual male competition. So if a male baboon is beating on another baboon to try to secure dominance and therefore access to the females, it's not like he's beating on his brother or his cousin. I mean, it's not likely. Males scatter off. So might as well go hard. Beat him down into submission. Be the dominant male. It's not quite like the Lion King portrayed it. Chimpanzees, on the other hand, common chimp here, the males stay with the troop they're born into. It's actually the females that leave. We don't know why there's a difference between, say, baboons and chimpanzees. It's not clear. Now you might go, wait a minute. I've watched Jane Goodall specials. I don't hear about female chimps taking off. Where would they go? Yeah, see, there's not a lot of places for them to go now. There's only about 9 sort of independent population areas of chimpanzees left in Africa, and they've become increasingly geographically isolated. But we know from both genetics studies and some cases of observations where there may be a troop separates still within a geographic area, that there is the movement. If individual chimps are going to leave a troop, it's generally going to be the females that will up and leave. Again, cuts down on inbreeding, so we've got outbreeding effects, spreads the genes around there. But because of this, because the males stay, I should say not all females leave, okay? It's not like every female leaves, but if members are going to leave the troop, it's most often going to be young females. Males will leave troops if they lose some dominance battles or get driven out. But in terms of sort of more voluntary leaving, it's more commonly the females. So because of this, the males can form kinship. They've got these kinship connections. So you get male-male alliances, males working with other males for hunting, for defense, for these sorts of things. Defense. Oh, and also female acquisition. Again, it's brothers, cousins, fathers, sons will sometimes work together. Often this works together in terms of hunting, because males that can bring meat back to females are more likely to be able to mate with those females. So males may work together. The hunting process feeds into the access to females process. In the bonobo chimpanzees, it's also the females that are more likely to leave and join another troop, but their internal alliance structure and system is very, very different. In bonobos, it's really the females that are much more dominant, socially dominant than the males. And new females coming in have to work really hard to establish alliances with the established the females that are already in the troop. Okay, so spending a lot of time trying to bring food to dominant females, to help care for their young, engage in sex with the dominant females. So these are all about maintaining social alliances. In both types of chimpanzees, common chimps and bonobos, The males are bigger than the females by maybe 25%. 25-30%. This is close to what we see in humans. But in the common chimpanzee, like the savannah baboons, males are dominant over females in sort of a hierarchy. Chimpanzees are complicated, actually. You've got actually parallel male and female hierarchies. In terms of things like troop defense, hunting, where the troop is going to go, it's usually the males that seem to lead those decisions. That being said, interestingly enough, dominant males in a troop usually come from dominant females. It's hard for a male to become high-ranking in a chimpanzee troop if his mom was a low-ranking female. So they're actually quite complicated here. But in bonobos, we've got a totally different system. We've got smaller females that seem to be dominant over the males. Now, this raises some interesting questions. If you remember back at the very beginning of the course, we discussed issues about people's personal biases and bringing these in to evolutionary psychology. So, depending... this is a question. We don't really have access to, say, the behavior patterns of Australopithecines, going back to our ancestors about 5 million years ago. But in terms of brain volume and in terms of physical structure and size, not dissimilar to the modern chimpanzees. Now keep in mind, modern chimpanzees did not come from Australopithecines. Australopithecines and modern chimpanzees branched off from a common ancestor before that. But it's not uncommon for modern researchers to look to the chimpanzees to try to get some insights into what our Australopithecine ancestors may have been like behaviorally. But here comes the question. Which chimpanzee should we use? Which is more representative? Should we look at the common chimpanzee, or should we use the bonobo? Now, the social structures are very different. In the common chimpanzee, the males probably are, say, the more dominant, although due to roles, dominance of their mothers as well. In the bonobos, though, it's really the females that are dominant. Common chimpanzees, much more aggressive than bonobos. Bonobos are sometimes called the peaceable chimp. I think they should be called the horny chimps, because they have sex a lot. But regardless. So, if you've got biases, if you think that humans are inherently aggressive, violent, hierarchical, with males that are being dominant, you may compare to the common chimpanzee. If you think that matriarchal systems are more important, equality between the sexes, less conflict is important, you may make the claim that our ancestors are more like the bonobos. Which is it? Hard to say. We'll talk later about warfare. Stuff based on what we know about warfare from hunter-gatherer groups and ancestral groups probably means we were closer to the common chimpanzee, despite the sort of idyllic, why can't we all just get along, desires of some people. Okay. In terms of humans here, in terms of our mating structure, mating patterns, culturally speaking, from culture perspective, over 70% of the cultures that are out there allow for some form of polygamy. So polygyny and polyandry. I'm saying cultures, not necessarily population. Okay? So I mean there's a lot of cultures that consist of less than 1,000 people. Right? Okay? So when you look at it that way, the numbers kind of rack up. Basically what we're seeing here is in most hunter-gatherer groups that still exist, there's not a lot of them, there's still a few. In most of the, less technologically driven agrarian groups, in these groups we tend to see polygyny and polygamy as acceptable forms of mating within the culture. That said, monogamy is extremely common. Now, monogamy is either what we call obligate or facultative. In obligate monogamy, the culture imposes rules and says there may only be, in a recognized relationship, two individuals. In facultative situations, if you can manage to secure more than one mate, go for it. But look, because the number of males and females is, barring extreme stressors on the system, more or less equal, if you have a polygynous structure in the culture where males, for example, can have multiple wives, if you've got some males that have more than one wife, you're going to have some males that will have no wives. Most of the males won't be able to afford more than one wife. Consequently, they'll be seen as monogamous. That's what we call facultative monogamy. So where should we actually be here in this scale? Well, if we look at this from sort of a biological perspective, we can look at testicle size. Generally speaking, the larger the testicles. Now, again, you see, this is where the terminology gets difficult. If you talk to biologists about this, they'll say, well, the larger the testicles, the more polygamous a species is, because the male has to fertilize, mate with lots and lots of females in a short period of time. So for something like elk, you've got a harem of 15 or 20 females, they'll all go into estrus at roughly the same time due to it being mating season. That elk's gotta try to mate with those females lots of times in very short, over the course of about 2 weeks. Means he needs to produce lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of sperm. That means big testicles. Compare this to something like chimpanzees. Well, chimpanzees happen in a slightly different way. Females don't have quite the same synchronous mating season, but when a female does go into heat, because chimpanzees are pretty much just promiscuous, the males will all be trying to mate with a female as often as possible. We enter what's called sperm competition. Whoever can leave the most sperm with the female is most likely to have his little wiggly guys get to the egg and do the job. So the larger the testicles, the faster you can make sperm. The faster you make sperm, the more likely you are to actually end up being the daddy of the little chick baby. Where do humans fit on this? Somewhere towards the sort of lower mid-scale of things. You know, when we compare testicle size to body mass, even just within the primates, we come out somewhere below sort of average. Which suggests that while we have some biological predispositions towards polygyny, it's not especially strong. In terms of sexual size dimorphisms, again, generally the greater the male-female difference in body size, the more polygynous the species is. Again, we come out somewhere on the lower end of this. So that kind of fits with this idea of facultative monogamy. So if you've got a male in a group that is successful enough to have enough resources to impress enough females, to be able to maintain enough females, great. That male may have multiple wives. The vast majority of males, though, will not. The vast majority will have one wife. The vast majority of women will have one husband at a time. And I'm just using the terms husbands and wives here, right? I mean, if it's just for ease of descriptors, okay? It could be like one significant other, whatever you want to call it, okay? So we're not the most polygamous of mammals out there. Neither are we the most promiscuous, despite, you know, what perhaps some of your friends might suggest to you, or my cousin in my case. Anyways, a little bit towards the shallow end of the gene pool there, my cousin. In terms of social organization, unsurprisingly, a great deal of social organization in primates involves mate choice. So if we look at things like gibbons, gibbons are fairly monogamous, actually. I mean, you may occasionally get some gibbons that cheat on one another, but they're actually generally pretty monogamous. The males actually will assist with the offspring. They're pretty sure that the offspring are, in fact, theirs. So we get that. Gorillas. Gorillas follow a polygamy situation. It's an age-graded system where it's said the oldest, most dominant male mates with the females. Orangutans, remarkably solitary. There's overlapping. There's a male that holds a territory, and his territory will overlap with multiple females, and he will be trying to mate with as many of those females as possible. Chimpanzees. In the common chimpanzees, you tend to see the strongest sort of alliances between males for hunting and territorial protection. Males don't generally form alliances with females. Females do have a social hierarchy structure, but I guess if you were to say, do they form alliances, females will have shared child rearing following kinship. So aunts and mothers will help raise young. The bonobos. Bonobos get complicated. There's a lot of promiscuity there. The strongest bonds are between the females, but the females will also make bonds with certain males. Not all of the males, but certain males. Even more so than in the common chimpanzee, a male status in the troop really depends on mum status. And mum status is a very complicated interplay between her mother status and the alliances that she's formed during her life. Finally, we get to humans, and again, depending on what culture of humans you look at, we got monogamy, polygamy, polyandry, and just plain old promiscuity. Now, again, probably, and I've mentioned this before, but one of the things with humans is we don't live in a specified environmental niche. We've spread all over the place. And then depending upon the environment that you're in, this is probably going to influence the sort of marriage patterns or bonding patterns that can be achieved. And it comes down to, can you support the young? What's going to be needed to support the young? So, we've talked about extrapyramidal populations a few times. You can have infidelity in any of these systems. Monogamous systems, polygamy systems, polyandry systems. I put promiscuity in here because sort of by its very definition, I guess you'd say promiscuity is infidelity incarnate. You're not forming any particular necessarily long-term bonds. We could quibble about that one. Can you have a fidelity in promiscuity? So by its nature, probably promiscuity is infidelity just there. Looking at this very traditionally, the assumption in many of the social sciences was that in humans, infidelity was due to males. Males were the ones that were off cheating on their partners. And the advantage, of course, would be if the males can manage to impregnate some other female, then they could get some additional offspring with a pretty low investment cost. That being said, if the males are off cheating, who are they cheating with? It takes two. So this idea that this was a male-driven system has more recently come under re-examination. In fact, over the last 20 years, it's been recognized that there can be some real advantages to female initiators of infidelity as well, primarily in terms of access to better genes. So, if you've got a female who is cheating, either is in a relationship, is cheating on her relationship, or is cheating with a male who is in another relationship, she's probably not going to get a huge amount in terms of resources. So what she's probably getting access to is high genotypic fitness. And in fact, research seems to support this. if the female is currently in a relationship, a long-term relationship, and we've talked about concealed estrus already, here's the thing. Males can have a very hard time determining whether or not they're actually the father of the offspring. Now, you can say, well, today, you know, you can just go on, say, the Jerry Springer show and get, you know, find out who the daddy is. Yeah, right. That's very recent. Go back even a few decades, you couldn't. There was no way of actually determining. So if you've got a female that's in a long-term relationship, cheats on her, let's just call it husband, if she can convince him that he really is, convince the husband he really is the father, if she's gone off and gotten excellent genes from some male, she gets excellent genes for her offspring and the resources from her husband. Win-win. Well, at least for the female. It's not really a win for her husband there. Okay? So, it works both ways. There can be advantages to infidelity for both sexes. In fact, whereas males will cheat almost, I mean, research says, given the opportunity, right, if there are females that the male can cheat with, good chance he will. Right? It's not tied to any particular issue here. But women, in fact, are more likely to cheat when they are reproductively receptive. In other words, when they are likely to get fertilized, have the egg fertilized. I mentioned this briefly, I think, last class. Women will actually change their appearance when they are most likely able to be fertilized. It's not something that is done consciously, the studies show, even without... So some women know exactly where they are in their monthly cycle. Many do not. And if studies have shown that some days women will just say, I feel like dressing sexier. I've got it. I'm going to flaunt it. Fine. No problem. Making no judgments on this whatsoever. But the point here that I'm making is, cognitively, the women may not even be thinking, whoa, oh, yeah, I bet I'm ovulating. No. The point is, evolution does this. What's the sort of evolution? How do you win the evolutionary game? Differential reproductive success. So, what's your brain chemistry saying? It's like, yeah, ovulation's about to take place. We should be having sex now. Cognitive. The cognitive brain kicks in. It's not a good time. I'm in university. I need to finish my degree. Then I got to work on my career. Once I get promoted a couple levels, get the corner office, have secured a nice bank account, I've got a few investments, maybe put a down payment on a condo, then I can worry about getting pregnant. No. Brain's just going, have sex now. Make baby. Male brains are almost always like that. As it turns out. But for the female, I was like, yeah, why are you waiting? It doesn't make sense. Because from an evolutionary perspective, you go back into the EEA, there was no corner office. There was no mutual fund. There was no having to save money for your kid's college education. Because there wasn't one. Every month is a chance to win at the game of evolution. How do you do that? You get a bunch of males to be interested in you. You make them look, and then you pick. And then you pick the best of them. Get their attention, and because female choice is common, get the males to show off, get the males' attention, and pick the best one. And the best one may be short-term, or the best one may be long-term. Comes down to female decisions there. But in studies that have looked at issues of risk-taking males, risk-taking males are preferred for one-night stands, not long-term relationships, as it turns out. Getting back to the study I mentioned that just came out with the brooding, pouting, looking slightly guilty about something I've done male. One-night stands. Short-term relationships. Okay. Long-term? No. Long-term, that's not what women are looking for. Long-term, women are looking for the resources, the investment, being able to be a reasonably good father. Are looking for long term. But they get this conflict, right? There's the conflict between the short term and the long term. Yeah.
Why would females want to reproduce more with risk-taking males?
Why would you reproduce with more risk-taking males? Good question. What do you think?
Sexual
Okay, that's one possibility. So by risk-taking, I mean being able to engage in dangerous activities, survive. So if you can do dangerous stuff, if you're a male that does dangerous stuff and lives, how good is your genome? It's got to be good, right? Or you're just inordinately lucky. Either way, there's something to be said for that. If you can do dangerous stuff and not be dead, that's a phenotypic indicator of genotype. And so if it's just for short term, right? Ever see the movie The Villain? Kirk Douglas, Arnold Schwarzenegger? Early Arnold Schwarzenegger film. Ran like a Wile E. Coyote cartoon, right? So there's the busty girl who has to get the money to the bank on time, or the bank's going to foreclose on her family farm. And there's the villain who gets hired, Kirk Douglas, who gets hired by the bank manager to make sure the money doesn't get there because he wants to foreclose on the farm. And then the girl meets up with Arnold Schwarzenegger's character, who is just called the Handsome Stranger. That's his name. That really is his name in the movie, Handsome Stranger. And matter of fact, at one point, the question is, you know, that's an interesting name, the girl says as they're traveling together. How did you get it? He says, it was my father's name. It's like, really? Yes, my mother only knew him for one night. You know, that's sort of, that's, you know, I don't do a very good Schwarzenegger. But that's it, the Handsome Stranger. Great genes, but no idea who he was. Yeah.
Does the risk-taking male fit inside the handicap hypothesis?
Yeah, risk-taking males would fall within that handicap hypothesis idea there. If you can do dangerous stuff and still be there, if you're able to keep injuring yourself and still be going, or run the risk of injury and still be going, then yeah, you're taking a handicap and you're still kicking, alive and kicking there. So, but you know, I mean, here comes the thing: risk-taking males. There was also saying, you know, risk-taking males are more likely to be having sex with more women, perhaps, and, you know, having more offspring too. Risk-taking males will do that. Risk-taking males are more likely to cheat. Other studies show that high testosterone-driven males are more likely to cheat on their partners. So here becomes the risk. If you're a female who's hooked up for the long term or longish term with a high testosterone-driven dominant male, just to pick on Schwarzenegger, for example, look what's happened recently, right? Odds are he's going to be off having sex with somebody else that's not you. Which means resources are going to be shared out with somebody else's kids, not yours. You want your kids to have the resources. So high testosterone, dominant, aggressive males may not be the best choice for good long-term relationships. Maybe great for short-term relationships because you get the good genes, but then you need to find a good long-term relationship male. Back in the EEA. I mean, nowadays you can just, you know, women can just make money on their own. Do it that way. At least some can. So, female infidelity becomes actually a pretty serious concern for males. Because if their long-term mate has been cheating on them, they may end up raising somebody else's offspring. So that's called genetic altruism. A couple of studies here from Boston 1989 found that males value virginity and chastity in women much more than women do in men. And that fits, okay? It fits with the idea that the concern that males have about genetic altruism. Boston Schmidt found in 1993 that American males rated faithfulness and sexual loyalty as the most highly valued traits in women for a long-term relationship. These were, in fact, not the values favored in a short-term relationship. For a short-term relationship, being easy was essentially exactly say it that way, but being willing to have sex was much more valued for the short-term relationship, not for the long-term. There's a difference here, interestingly. Into the late 90s, by the middle 90s, mid-90s, there was a number of studies that were starting to come out and look at this. Harris, in 2000, did sort of a meta-analysis of a number of studies here, looking at what's called emotional and sexual infidelity. So sexual infidelity is having sex with somebody else that you're and possibly producing offspring with somebody else. Emotional infidelity, though, is forming a strong emotional bond with somebody who is not your long-term partner. Harris found by doing an analysis of about a dozen other studies that had looked at this that women were more bothered by emotional infidelity in their partner. So across the studies, from 62 to 86% of women said they were more bothered by emotional infidelity than sexual infidelity. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that the women weren't upset at their partners for being sexually unfaithful. But what really worried them was if their partners were being sexually unfaithful and had formed an emotional connection with another woman. Matter of fact, even if their male partners weren't perhaps even sexually unfaithful at this point, emotional unfaithfulness, that is forming a stronger emotional relationship with another woman than her, was worrying, because you make that strong emotional connection. Well, could the sexual infidelity be too much further behind? Maybe, maybe not. But that's the concern. Sexual infidelities, yeah, okay, not happy about it, but as long as it was a one-time thing, if that happens, right, then fine. But making a strong emotional connection to the woman, very worrying. Okay. Males, on the other hand, across the studies, this ranged from 47% to 60%, were more bothered by sexual infidelity. Surprisingly, actually very, very unconcerned with emotional infidelity. I mean, not entirely unconcerned, but it's like, fine, gosh, I'm spending all kinds of time having a great emotional bond with somebody else. More time for me to watch hockey, whatever. So, you know, not as big of a concern. The concern was sexual infidelity. We'll talk more about step-family relationships later on in the course here. But children from previous relationships are problematic. You end up being step-parents. So if you're a step-parent, you're investing resources into a non-biological offspring, genetic altruism. In terms of looking for mates, this becomes a detractor. Okay, so you're looking for a mate, and the mate, possible future mate, has kids from a prior relationship, those are resources. Any resources you have to go into those children as well as any children you may be producing with this future mate. People that are divorcees with children have a hard time finding, or a harder time, shall we say, finding future long-term mates. It can be more difficult. Okay, so let's take a look at this in terms of I was about to say real-world context, but that's not entirely true. Let's take a look at it through the lens of reality television. I both hate and love reality television. I actually hate watching it because I think it's awful. I love the concept, though, from sort of an evolutionary psychology perspective, because while I know many reality, so-called reality television shows are somewhat scripted in how they do things, they are less scripted than, say, you know, a television drama or, you know, whatever it happens to be, right? A sitcom, a something. Those are entirely scripted by the writers. And then the writers write what they think somebody wants to watch, and they bring in all of their cultural underpinnings and their, you know, stuff from going through writing school and how they're going to write the next great, you know, Canadian or American novel or blah, 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 blah. When you get into things like reality television, be it the evening shows, or even, say, talk shows, right, like Springer or Montel or, you know, Oprah going back about 10 years, okay, they're interesting because they're just tapping into stuff that people do. And people will say just bizarre, and do, just bizarre crap on these. But it's somewhat realer than the kinds of things that will show up on scripted TV. You can get some very interesting insights into human behavior by watching this stuff. So I said, I mean, I think it's fascinating, but I hate watching it. It just, it bothers me for some reason. It's probably an age-related issue. It's also kind of the, I know that networks are doing this just because it's really, really cheap to produce. And so we don't have to do any sort of quality television. We can just do this. And besides, I can just look out my back window and watch all the things that are going on with, you know, the neighbors across the way, that in the apartment complex, and hey, there's all your drama for you right there. There's a rather long history to reality television. If you want to take it back into the 1950s, we've got Candid Camera that would do this. If you've never seen Candid Camera, they set up funny little situations and watch what people would do and then film this. The sort of modern take on reality television goes back to MTV's Real World, which started in 1992. Nowadays, we have things like Survivor and whatnot. Just to give you a look at this, use Survivor as an example, these have become extremely popular. So the final episode of Survivor from 2000 pulled in 51 million viewers. That's huge. Massive. Even the Survivor Palau from, what was it, 2006 or something like this, premiered to over almost 24 million viewers. And you go, that's not that much. It was a Thursday night in the middle of February. That's like the dead time. This is like the worst possible time to try to premiere something. And they still pulled in almost 24 million viewers. Okay, reality, it's cheap to make and people watch it. Now you might ask why people watch reality television. I mean, there's an interesting sort of evolutionary psychology slant on this. Let's assume that we did evolve in small social groups. Well, what do you do in the small social group? You know what's going on with everyone else in your small social group, right? And because your social group isn't that large, paying attention to what's happening with other members of your social group, who said what to who, who just broke up with who got together with who, whose kids may not actually be their kids, these sorts of things. That can have an impact on you if you're part of that group. If there's internal strife in the group, what's it going to do to you? How's it going to affect you? And so, in the same way, humans are quite drawn to, you know, watching accidents on the highway, having, you know, something disastrous happens and you just gotta watch it. Why? Well, because that might happen to you. Paying attention to stuff that's dangerous, if you know what the dangerous stuff is, it's less likely to affect you. Same way. In terms of the social stuff, if you know what's going on socially around you. Now, most of us live in a fairly isolated social existence, right? We don't know everybody that lives in our apartment building or on our block. We don't live in extended tribal networks. But we can get a lot of this drama, if you will, social drama, through the reality television. Probably taps into something that's very, very evolved. If you got some, Facebook, same thing, social media, same thing. It's popular because we're a social species. Knowing what is happening with other members of your group, that's important. Let's just take a look at a couple of finding a mate shows. Now, these get divided into long-term and short-term. So things like Bachelor or Bachelorette are long-term. Short-term are things like Eliminate. Okay, we're going to consider a few things, resources, attractiveness, and fidelity here. On the long-term shows, these are usually more than a single episode. They usually run through a season or at least a big chunk of a season. Generally speaking, the males aren't quite as, if we compare this to the short-term, shows, the males aren't quite as blatant about displaying resources. They generally have them, but they're not necessarily going to be covered in a whole bunch of trashy gold chains, okay? Or be showing off their souped-up Honda Civic, or something like that. Right? If you will, the cast appears a bit classier. And the aim of these longer-term mating shows is the winner is supposed to be finding a husband or a wife, not a short-term fling. Now, that being said, I think in most of the either Bachelor or Bachelorettes that have been done over the about last 8 years or so, there may only be one or two out of the something like 16 or so 15 or so series that have actually lasted. So these tend not to do all that well in terms of relationships. But still, that's the aim. For the short-term mating shows, usually a single episode, occasionally somebody gets brought back in the second episode. Just to sort of generalize here, women are showing a lot more skin. Males are explicitly trying to show a lot of bling. And both sexes often will deceive one another, either blatantly by just outright lying or by just not giving quite the whole truth about something or redirecting the question in a different direction. Okay. Spit and Bus found that if you're looking for a long-term partner, this applies to both sexes, what you should do is act helpfully, honestly, kindly, and sensitively. Starting out as becoming friends is a good thing. Communication is very important here. Invoke love at some point, show commitment. And if there are rivals for that potential future significant other, describe the rivals as exploitative, selfish, and insensitive. This works for both sexes. Breaking it down a bit further here, for females looking for a long-term male partner, females should display sexual exclusivity and question rivals' fidelity. Basically imply that rivals sleep around a lot. Males looking to attract females for the long term, display resources, but not in kind of a trashy way. So show that there is stability in the resources for the future. Demonstrate commitment. Derogate rivals' achievements and resource potential, suggest rivals lack goals. So you can see there's sort of a difference between these two here. In terms of short-term partners, Buster Schmidt found that females, interestingly, the females over the males tend to maintain higher standards. Drop a bit, but still, you got to compare between the sexes. Females tend to keep their standards a bit higher. In other words, males are much more likely to accept some sort of minimum for access to casual sex. And in fact, actually, Bussenschmidt found that males would reject women with indications of either a low sex drive, prudishness, or the desire for commitment. One thing that's going to kill short-term relationships for males is the desire for commitment. That's the point of a short-term relationship, I suppose. High promiscuity was favored for short-term or not long-term partners. Actually, for both sexes. So if you're looking for a short-term relationship, you're probably looking for sex. For females trying to attract a male, act flirtatious and seductive, sexualize the appearance, make sexual propositions, downplay intelligence. I know, that's kind of a tough... Bussenschmidt aren't saying that they endorse this. It's just they're saying this is what happens. This is what women do. If women are actually smarter than the male, right? You know, you're a handsome stranger. Yes. Yeah. Try to downplay the intelligence, you know. Laugh at the jokes, even if they're not very funny. Having sex and calling rivals sexually unavailable are the things to do for short term. In the male for the short term. For males trying to track females for the short term, give resources immediately, demonstrate machismo, so act dominant, display dominance, confidence, and resources, show off in some way, and derogate rivals' resources here. So, let's take a look at things like male success in Bachelorette. So in Bachelorette, it's the woman looking to find a long-term male, looking for a husband. The men that show up on Bachelorette often describe themselves as intelligent or ambitious, and they will make reference to their resources. Just for example, you know, the men have to do sort of like a little opening bio sort of thing, and they're often say things like, "My greatest achievements were..." So, actually two Chris's in this case. So Chris C and Chris M. Chris C, owning my own home and business, and Chris M for Bachelor 3, graduating from Stanford Business School while starting companies along the way. Now, he doesn't say whether any of those companies actually survived, but you know, that's great achievements there. Oh, yes, look, it's Andrew Firestone, the chin that walks like a man. Now, again, these are somewhat scripted, right? Because the production staff picks which males they bring on. But even within this context here, we get something interesting. So in Bachelorette, the favorite sort of men that get brought on, they're generally relatively successful, things like lawyers, business executives, sports agents, these kinds of things. On The Bachelor, at least through the sort of early years of this, shifted a little bit with time, and there were some spin-offs. But generally the bachelors, so when they're looking for a wife, are extremely successful. Or they might be heirs to fortunes like good old Andrew here. So Andrew Firestone, Firestone Tires, that family, make tires. Well, you got the idea. So really, really rich. With respect to success, so in Bachelor, so again, the male looking for a wife, women are generally less successful than the Bachelor in terms of sort of social hierarchy or socioeconomic status, something like that. Students, service industry, things like that. The Bachelorettes, though, actually, on the other hand, are fairly successful, but usually of a bit lower, if you will, social status than the male counterparts in The Bachelor. So, for example, Bachelorette 2, Meredith, she was a makeup artist, apparently very well respected within like Hollywood circles and things like that. In Bachelorette 4, you ended up with Deanne Pappas. She was a very successful real estate agent. The guy she picked, Jesse, though interestingly enough, was a professional snowboarder. Now, is that a step? I mean, who's got the higher social status? Successful real estate salesman, you know, professional snowboarder. I don't know. As it turns out, they didn't last. It lasted about a year, announced their engagement, broke up. So, didn't do too well there. In terms of age range here, for the Bachelorette, so we say for Bachelorette 3, 25 men, one woman. Jim, the Bachelorette, was 28. Average age of the men was 30. Range was 25 to 37. Remember we said generally if he was looking for males slightly older, so a few males, a little bit younger, but average was older and we're going significantly above there. Bachelor 6 was a little unusual. They had two males in there, Byron and Jay. They were both 40. The average age of women was 32 with a range of 27 to 39. So in this example of Bachelor, none of the women were actually older than the Bachelor. So again, that fits with stuff we've seen here before. Now again, these are taken to somewhat more of an extreme. We're doing this for television, but it's representative. With respect to attractiveness, these get a little bit different here. I mean, most women that are going to show up in reality television are considered to be at least average or above average in appearance. Reality television isn't really real in the sense that it's television still. So you're not really going to get a complete Gaussian, right? It's not a random selection of people. So we still have average or above average appearance here. Then again, this is what Buss has found that males tend to favor. The male physical attractiveness on reality TV has not been as consistent. But again, if it's more resources that are significant, then that's not as much of a problem. And in fact, as we discussed earlier, women don't rank physical attractiveness as generally their top feature when looking for long-term mates. So these patterns do get predicted. Who do we have? We got, I don't know. Oh, do you remember the first one there is from Are You Hot? Do you remember Are You Hot? Yeah, it lasted for, I think, 1.5 seasons. So like three series. Are You Hot was incredibly trashy. Basically, that was the whole thing. Are you hot or not? And the judges would just grade you on hotness. Personality didn't matter. Goals don't care. It was strictly a meat market kind of show. The interesting thing with Are You Hot was... It didn't work. People, it got dropped. Viewers didn't like it. as a reality TV program, there wasn't any of the social drama. It was just week after week of really attractive people. Okay, even the ones that aren't the hottest, the ones that got buzzed off the show, were still hot, right? Which means most of them are probably hotter than most of the viewers out there watching television, which means it just makes you feel bad about yourself. Right? And with no social drama or anything going on, why do you need to watch that? You didn't. I did find it interesting, though, that the judges would actually critique the males. So the males would generally on this have just stunning upper body musculature. Built, right? But very commonly they'd ignore their lower body. And the judges would actually call them on this. I found it interesting the judges would call them on this. It's like, you know, yes, terrific upper body physique, but look, you've got little chicken legs. And they have like laser pointers. And it's like, look at this over there. It's like, there's nothing down there. It's like, huh. Good call. All right, interesting. So, yeah, a couple of things from, I think, Bachelorette and Bachelor. And then I think this last one is something like Temptation Island, which is also just tawdry trash. But still, interesting when we get into talking about Machiavellian intelligence later on. Interestingly enough, in some of these long-term shows, at least, some of the men can gain popularity by their personality. So in Bachelorette 1, there was one of the guys that was on, Bob, was slightly overweight, but female fans really liked him because he seemed very genuine and he had a nice sense of humor, and they were really upset. Female fans, like, writing in to Bachelorette 1, really upset when he got dumped from the show, when he was voted off. Or not voted off, but, I mean, the Bachelorette said, no, not you. And they were, like, really upset. And so he came back, actually. He became the Bachelor for Bachelor 4. So he got his own show because he was so popular with the female fans. Adam Mesh, this guy down here, was... They tried to do something called Average Joe. So instead of, like, massively successful Andrew Firestones and, you know, dot-com startup types and, you know, all these things. He was so popular in Average Joe, again, didn't win, Average Joe won, that he got his own show as well. He came at Average Joe, Adam Returns. So now he's looking for a mate. So from Average Joe, Adam Returns, there he is, surrounded by a whole bunch of women, and comes down to these two. So these are the two final women of choice. We had Samantha, who's a sales clerk, self-described socialite wannabe, and her own words, not into deep thinking. Or, I'm not making this up, okay? I mean, not. Rachel, elementary school teacher, likes kids. Adam's mom loved Rachel. Who did Adam pick? Yeah, he went with Samantha. Don't know what his mom thought about that. So, there we have. Now, we talked a little bit about issues of step-parenting, having step-kids there. And we actually see some examples of this in reality television. In Bachelorette 1 and 3, respectively, 9 out of 25 and 12 out of 25 of the men, in their opening little bio statements, stated that they were either loyal or trustworthy or honest, something to that effect. So about half of them, you know, are saying, whoa, my first impression here... need to slip something in about this. On Bachelor 2, the guy, Aaron, he was bothered that one of the final three women, Wynn there, had actually been previously married. It bothered him. Didn't pick her. Now, I mean, honestly, I don't know that he was like expecting that any of the women that were showing on this were actually virgins at this point, but still, it seemed to bother him. She'd had a husband and obviously had engaged in carnal relations. Bit of a jerk, really, when you come right down to it, don't you? Anyhow, I forgot which of the Bachelors it was, but this was, I think, 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, I guess, 2 years, whatever. Again, one of the guys, one of the women that was in, like, I think the final six, did have a child, and at least that Bachelor was very sort of, you know, upfront about decisions. It's like, this is just, you know, I don't know how I'm going to deal with that and try to start a relationship. So, Average Joe 3 here. Yeah, there he is again there. He eliminated Brittany there when she told him that she had a 6-year-old son. And he did. He as well was pretty upfront, saying he would just add one more complicating element to the relationship. So, kids are dumb. And we look at personal ads. Some places actually run specific personal ads for, like, people that have kids, for people that have kids. Let me take 10. Let me take 10 at this point, and we'll go on from here.